The world is not as it should be. This is a judgment that we all share, Orthodox or liberal, conservative or progressive, hopeful or despairing. And constitutive of this judgment, internal to it, as its shadow or its echo, is a prayer, "Thy kingdom come." That is, every time we make the judgment that the world is not that it as it should be, we have some sense, some vision, sometimes quite specific, but more often rather inchoate, of how the world should be, and we long for that, yearn for that, pray for that. Even if we have lost all faith in prayer, even if we cannot envision what the kingdom might be, even if the "thy" of "thy kingdom come" has lost all resonance for us, even if we never had it in the first place, even if we despair that the kingdom, whatever it is, will ever come, or even if we cynically mock those who, like naive children, still believe in such nonsense, even if all of these conditions apply, every time we make the judgment, the world is not as it should be, we say a prayer, voiced or not, believed or not, in the form of a prayer or some other, "Thy kingdom come." I cannot prove this assertion, but it is my wager. And this because the judgment that the world is not as it should be is of a peculiar kind. It is not an intellectual judgment, for neither the theological teaching of providence, nor Nietzsche's doctrine of eternal return, nor Leibniz's philosophical proof that ours is the best of all possible worlds can entirely still our minds about it, just as the scientific theory of natural selection cannot quite convince us that there is no should after all. Neither is it an emotional judgment, as our feelings fluctuate with our days and our diets, leaving us more or less hopeful, more or less optimistic, more or less energized, but not ultimately affecting our sense that, on a grander scale, things could and should be better. Though I am struggling for words here, I am tempted to call the judgment, "The world is not as it should be," a spiritual judgment. The word spirit, ruach in Hebrew, pneuma in Greek, has as its core sense wind or breath. It has to do with both the principle of life and with movement, with a living dynamism, which is why the Latin for spirit, anima, is at the root of our term animation. I am calling this judgment, "The world is not as it should be," a spiritual judgment because, as dynamic, or as the judgment of a dynamic, it does not, as do intellectual or emotional judgments, give itself to be stilled. Making such a judgment moves us, or is already a movement, towards something else, something that is not, namely, that which is traced out in the vision, the sense, the hope, however obscure, of how things should be, in terms of which we make the judgment that things are not as they should be. Our very judgment that the world is not as it should be draws us of itself out of our complacency with the present reality into a future that is not given to us, even if it is our hope, things can be different, and a promise, things will be different. Living our hope as a promise is at the heart of faith. However dark the glass through which we see that which is not but should be, we strain to see it because it beckons us, and we long for it. It won't let us rest. In the dark light of the judgment of a world gone wrong, we see, as if in silhouette, a trace of what could and should be. And we know ourselves tasked with sowing the seeds of life that will transform what might be into what is. We all have a dream, even if our waking preoccupation with what is eclipses our facility to conjure it up. Now there are, for those with eyes to see, at least as many reasons to lose hope in our hope and to despair of the promise as there are to believe in it. The idealistic ways in which we frame our various visions of the kingdom might inspire us to keep trekking through the cumbersome muck of reality, and in itself, that is worth a lot. But these days, we are mostly too worldly wise to believe that the kingdom is actually coming, however good a show of belief we might put on in public. No biologist who has actually studied instincts, not to mention animal digestive systems, actually believes that the lion will ever lay down with the lamb, at least not past mealtime. And at the end of the 20th century, no historian worth her salt actually believes that nation states will ever beat their swords into plowshares. In the private councils of our own discernment of reality, we know that these are mere metaphors, ideals to inspire us, but not realities after which we might actually aspire. If the prospects of hope and change fill our lungs and imaginations with a revivifying fresh air for a season, 4 years later, we know better. In the end, everything reverts back to business as usual. Everything reverts back to business as usual. And if we are honest, even the most ideological supply-siders among us know that business is not the superhighway to the kingdom either. As much as we want to believe otherwise, in our most sober moments, we are more likely to begrudgingly acknowledge that we can't get there from here. And we lament with the preacher of Ecclesiastes, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And if at the turn of the previous century, one could find a believer in comprehensive human progress on every gaslit street corner, since the most recent turn of the century, one searches almost in vain for anyone who still believes there is a correlation between scientific technological progress on the one hand and human moral progress on the other. We are left with little, if any, reason to believe that our prayer, "Thy kingdom come," will be answered. The news is bad, and perhaps getting worse. But according to the Gospels, the good news of the kingdom is not offered to those with eyes to see, but with ears to hear. While we cannot see any way to get there, the kingdom yet beckons us, calls to us. That's why the scripture defines faith as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That's why faith is not belief, and why if we reduce faith to belief, we strip it of what is most interesting and important about it. We only believe in things that are possible, things that we can realistically foresee. For impossible things, we have to have faith. And that's why the Danish thinker, Søren Kierkegaard, is right to assert that faith is both the hardest and the highest thing of all. And it is the hardest and highest thing of all because faith cannot exist in some nether realm where its pure ideality can be preserved against the ravages of harsh reality, like the pauper who closes his eyes at night and imagines his sack a princely robe. Faith is only faith if it transforms the world, if the impossible becomes possible, if things in fact become as they should be. Otherwise, it is not faith, but mere fancy. The existentialist philosophers do a nice job of describing the dynamic movement at the heart of the human way of being, of showing us how we are caught up in our very existence in this tension between what is and what is not. Indeed, to exist is to be outside of oneself. In Latin, es, the infinitive esse, means to be, and ex means out of. Another way to put this is to say that to be human is to have projects. To have a project is to throw oneself forth. In Latin, pro means forth, and jacere means throw. To throw oneself into a future that is not yet, but that nevertheless impinges on the present as integral to it. We are all here and now, in this place, today. But we are here to conduct the business of Canadian Yearly Meeting. And what we transact this week, we transact for the sake of the future of Canadian Yearly Meeting as a whole, and for the sake of our testimony and ministry to the world going forth. That is our project. That's why we're here. The then and there is the very meaning of the here and now. What is not the case, what we are projecting, is at least important to what is the case as what is in fact the case. What is not the case is as essential to human reality as what is the case, which is why facts do not have a corner on reality, and while science, while it speaks an essential word, does not have the only or the last word. Jean-Paul Sartre puts this graphically when he says, human reality must be what it is not, and not be what it is. The unreal future affects the reality of the present as much, and perhaps more than, the reality of the present affects the future. We begin then to catch a glimpse of a circularity between the real and the not real, between the present and the future, that I am tying in this lecture to the notion of spirit. But we only have this structure as human beings because we are temporal beings, beings who live in and with an awareness of time. Indeed, time itself takes shape across this relationship between what is and what is not. If we are to have time, we must have both a continuity between what was, what is, and what might yet be, and a decisive break between what was, what is, and what might yet be. If everything were frozen in perpetual sameness, there would be no time, for time is a measure of change. Yet if every instant brought complete and total newness, total transformation, there would be nothing against which time as change could be measured. And that is why Kierkegaard, if I may refer to him once again, claims that eternity cannot be the same frozen as always the same, because that would be an eternity out of time. And being out of time would be an odd definition of eternity, which should be full of time, always having more of it. Rather, eternity must be the perpetual possibility of a new beginning, which Kierkegaard refers to as repetition. Time itself, like the lives that we live within it, is an open continuity. At the social level, I suggest that an open continuity is not such a bad definition for a tradition. This is not surprising, because a tradition is an attempt by a group to move effectively through time. It is unfortunate that the term tradition has come to be associated with being stuck in the past, since the term itself suggests rather the opposite. Traditio, in Latin, from trans, which means across, and dare, which means give, does not mean to hang on to something, but to give it over, or to pass it on. It names a gift that is passed down through the generations. It is not, as is too often thought, the tedious repetition of the same, but the perpetual regeneration of the gift. The giving of a gift has two aspects. First, it requires that I have something of worth to give, and secondly, that I really give it, that I genuinely let it go. When I give a gift, it now belongs to someone else, and they can do with it what they will and what they must. Conservatives and liberals are both bad at tradition in this sense. Conservatives hand on the gift, but at the same time refuse to really let go of it, and so don't really give it over at all. Here is the gift, but you must do with it exactly what I did with it, and I am going to direct its use even from beyond the grave. This is, in a sense, what creeds do, at least at their worst, and why Quakers have always been nervous about them. This conservative gesture is well-intentioned, of course. We desire to give our children the best that we have. We want to save them the pain and the struggles that we went through in acquiring and formulating and refining the gift we now give. But this is a giving that keeps one hand on the gift to direct its subsequent use, even as it's given with the other hand. It demonstrates a lack of trust and a perhaps perverted sense of generosity. Conservatives give gifts, but with strings attached. Liberals, on the other hand, tend not to give gifts, at least of this kind. This is not because they lack generosity, but because, as progressives, they believe the new is always going to be better than the old. And why would we want to burden our children with our worn-out, out-of-date, heavy and ponderous stuff when all the bright and shiny new stuff is waiting for them just around the corner? Liberals are therefore also bad at receiving gifts. Grandpa's creed is of no more value to me than Grandma's couch. I'll get my own, thank you very much. But that also sometimes makes them ungrateful for, or even blind to, what they do receive. Okay, here's the rub. I have been trying with all of the foregoing to understand what it means to be part of a living tradition. I am proposing that we understand the larger Quaker movement as just such a living tradition, and seek to understand what it means for us today to be participants in it. One of the goals I set myself in preparing these lectures was the very likely impossible task of preparing lectures that could be presented at and have resonance within any of our Quaker yearly meetings, whether that be a yearly meeting affiliated with Friends General Conference, Friends United Meeting, Evangelical Friends International, or one of the conservative yearly meetings. And I have therefore been attempting to speak, perhaps to the discomfort of some, in turn and simultaneously in multiple Quaker dialects. In this, I expected to fail, and almost certainly have. But the goal remains: to try and understand the divisions within Quakerism, not, as we so often do, as mutually hostile forces, or even as mutually tolerated solitudes, but as sub-movements within the larger Quaker movement. So while Quakerism is legitimately called a religious society, or participation in a certain set of practices, or adherence to a certain set of beliefs, or a way of life, depending on the predilections of individual friends, it is, in the context I am here setting out, at least as legitimately thought of as a movement. That is, as a dynamic interplay between what is and was, and what yet might be. Between what it has been and what it is always becoming. It is that tension I have been suggesting here that is life. And it is also the very life of Quakerism as a living tradition. That is, as an open continuity. Quakers historically and in general have always been suspicious of tradition because of its tendency to harden into the dead forms of traditionalism that quench the life of the spirit. Even while Quakers of all kinds have recognized the necessity of this life taking concrete formation in the world across a living tradition, even if across diverse groupings of friends we have different ideas about what kinds of forms are most propitious for this purpose. But we all have our traditions, what we think serves this life. Whether statements of traditional Quaker belief, like the Richmond Declaration, or the conservation of traditional Quaker forms of worship, like silent meetings. As suspicious as we are of traditionalism, we all preserve and perpetuate something of the tradition, or else we wouldn't recognize ourselves as friends. Indeed, while we hope to be open to new light as we deliberate over important issues at this yearly meeting, we also know that we are not open to just anything. Certain ideas might well be deemed to be not in the spirit of friends, and even certain procedures deemed to be out of gospel order. A tradition remains a living tradition, then, only if there is an open continuity, only if the forms in which we live are themselves open to renewal, and only if the innovative is consistent with what has opened onto it, without being determined by it, for then it would not be truly innovative, but just more of the same. The idea of an open continuity that I have explored in this lecture is, I am proposing, parallel to the biblical idea of fulfillment that I looked at in the opening two lectures. In each case, we have a structure or a form that is established as a response to some call to life, which has to be perpetually revisioned if it is to remain a responsible response to that call and not sink into self-satisfied immobility. I would now like to rebrand this notion of an open continuity, this dynamic of fulfillment, with a term I hope will resonate with Quakers and will open yet another vista upon the larger framework I am suggesting as a way of understanding our respective places within the larger Quaker movement. The term I would like to suggest is radicalizing spirit. Indeed, the term radical harbors a wonderful ambiguity. The etymological origin of the term radical is the Latin radix, which means root. So among the dictionary meanings of radical is the following: forming an inherent or fundamental part of the nature of someone or something. Here then, something is at its most radical when it is rooted most securely in what it is. But the term radical also has taken on another meaning, obviously related to, but seemingly contradictory to the first. On this meaning, radical refers to a change or action relating to or affecting the fundamental nature of something. And it is this meaning that gives us radical in the sense of something characterized by departure from tradition, innovative or progressive, and as advocating a thorough or complete political or social reform. The term radical can mean either being deeply rooted or tearing something up from the roots. It can mean either being bound firmly and securely to its ground or being liberated from such an attachment altogether. What I am working towards suggesting in these lectures is that this either-or is perhaps a false choice, and that we might do well to think of them in terms of both-and. That is, that these two senses of radical are not disjunctive, are not actually opposed to one another, but depend upon each other. In philosophy, we refer to this kind of mutually dependent relationship between terms in tension as a dialectical one. In Greek, dia means through, and legein means to speak, which means that the two senses of the term are in conversation with each other. Answer to one another. So just as for Jesus, fidelity to the law meant that the law needed to be opened up, driven beyond itself, so for early Quakers, fidelity to the Spirit of Christ meant that Christianity needed to be opened up, driven beyond itself. What I am suggesting in this lecture is that this structure is not unique to Jesus or to Quakers, but is part and parcel of what it means to be alive. Life is alive, is animated by the dialectical relationship between what is and what is not, but should be, between the past and the future, between, on the one hand, the grounding practices, and, on the other hand, the aspirations of a living tradition. In this context, I would like to suggest that we understand the term spirit to name this restless circulation between what is and what might be, what should be, what must be. The spirit of something names the way in which this dynamic, this interplay of open continuity, is taken up in any particular case. A spiritual movement is one in which the structures of a particular movement open up upon new possibilities that, in being realized, transform the original structures themselves, which in turn open up upon yet again further new possibilities. Our understandings of ourselves open up new possibilities for reforming our world, which in turn transform our understandings of ourselves, which in turn open up yet other new possibilities to be realized. That is what it means to be alive in a spiritual sense. And this is why we speak of spiritual movements. Spirits are on the move, are restless, like everyone born of the Spirit, who, according to John's Gospel, is like the wind that bloweth where it listeth, in defiance of all of our expectations. That's why trusting spirits is always a matter of faith. Not quite formless, but living beyond their forms, restlessly seeking forms from which they are perpetually expelled, spirits seem simultaneously to be and not to be, inhabit the interspaces between being and not being, which is why we associate spirits with ghosts and specters. I do not believe in ghosts, but I do believe we are called to discern spirits, a practice long at the heart of Quakerism. For not all spirits are holy spirits. The restless circulation between what is and what yet might be creates an energy, energies in which we, as spiritual beings, get caught up. The spirit of the Olympics, the spirit of capitalism, the spirit of Quakerism. The spirits in which we participate, the new possibilities that we realize in continuity with who we already are constitute the textures of our lives. If the realization of possibilities in actualities opens up new possibilities that in turn allow for richer actualities per infinitum, we have a living or a Holy Spirit, the Spirit of life. But where the realization of possibilities closes down the potential for further possibilities, which in turn impoverishes our actuality, we are faced with a spirit of death. If we are to understand Quakerism as a living tradition, I suggest we understand it across its radicalizing spirit. That is, across the dialectical tension between the forms it has taken, its radicality in the sense of being rooted, and the ever new possibilities opened up by these forms without being contained within them, its radicality in the sense of ongoing and fundamental transformation. A living tradition can no more leave the forms in which it is realized behind than it can settle comfortably into them. They, in their turn, are transformed by the possibilities opened up across them. They are fulfilled, which means they are neither abandoned, nor do they stay the same. That, at least, was the suggestion of the previous lecture. And indeed, the important and perplexing issue of the relationship of Quakerism to Christianity, which I will take up again in the next lecture, I am trying to illuminate against the background of this idea of Quakerism as a radicalizing spirit. By way of anticipation, I would like here to borrow a formula from a recent book that grew out of a seminar held at the Woodbrook Quaker Study Center in Birmingham, England, around the identity of Quakerism. England, staged to encourage an open and honest discussion around the identity of Quakerism between a Christian Quaker, Timothy Ashworth, and Alex Wildwood, representing emerging other than Christian expressions of Quaker faith. The title of their book and the formula I would like to borrow is Rooted in Christianity, Open to New Light. I think this description of Quakerism is apt and true, both in an historical, sociological sense and in a spiritual sense. Part of what I am aiming at in these lectures is to propose a theoretical framework that will allow us to understand the two sides of this description, not disjunctively, but as forming a coherence, not as divided, but as distinct but interrelated moments within a larger whole. À demain.